Here, Sri Aurobindo is continuing his analysis of this nature of Maya as an illusion and of the human being as subject to it, and the relation of these two to Brahman, which is being assumed from the Upanishads to be the only reality there is. And if that is the case, then the others must be somehow part of it or related to it. They cannot be outside it, as it were. If they are, then we end up with a duality of some kind. So this is how he goes through this analysis, and he looks at each one of these as the one who perceives, the percipient, and then what it looks at or perceives is the world, and that is therefore the percept. And then you have, you know, the perception of this. And the last time he was considering the individual as the percipient. So there, of course, the problem arose that if the world was an illusion projected by Maya, then the individual also was an illusion. So then the big question was then that what is it that is experiencing this illusion, and what is it, what does it mean to get out of that, to be liberated from that? And so this consideration is what he is continuing with now. Previously, he posited the fact of Brahman's reality as somehow entering into this illusion, but he ends by again talking about the duality that that presents. As he says over here, to avoid this conclusion, it may be said that our individuality is unreal. It is Brahman who withdraws from a reflection of itself in the figment of individuality, and its extinction is our release, our salvation. So this kind of you know, view, which I'm not sure if it actually is one of the varieties of philosophically through which Advaita presents itself. However, can be adapted to explain Buddhism. Though in Buddhism, of course, Brahman is not posited. So we have this kind of a situation, and he says, if it be said that it does not suffer, that it not suffer real bondage or profit, if it be said that it is a conscious reflection of figment, and therefore can really suffer and enter into the bliss of release, the question arises, whose is the consciousness that so suffers in this fictitious existence? For there can be no real consciousness except that of the one existence. So that once more there is established a dual consciousness for Brahman, a consciousness of superconscience free from the illusion, and a consciousness subject to the illusion. And we have again substantiated a certain reality of our existence and experience in Maya. For if our being is that of the Brahman, our consciousness something of the consciousness of the Brahman, with whatever qualification, it is to that extent real. And if our being, why not the being of the universe? So, in other words, that Brahman is experiencing this. Brahman has somehow accepted this experience of illusion and as the individual. And therefore, whatever we call this experience of illusion is also most probably nothing but Brahman that is presenting itself as the solution. It is only by such an understanding that one can give some credence to these two poises, as it were, of the Brahman. But still, it becomes like a duality, unless we say that it is a deliberate choice of the Brahman to self-segregate and hold itself in these two transcendental and cosmic poises, and an individual poise within the cosmic poise. So that is how he ends the previous paragraph. And now he will continue looking at that particular option with a little more, finesse, you may say.
John Robert, would you like to start reading?
Sure. It may finally be put forward as a solution that the percipient individual and the percept universe are unreal, but Maya, by imposing itself on Brahman, acquires a certain reality, and that reality lends itself to the individual and to its experience in the cosmic illusion, which endures so long as it is subject to the illusion. But again, for whom is the experience valid? The reality acquired while it endures. And for whom does it cease by liberation, extinction, or withdrawal? For an illusory, unreal being cannot put on reality and suffer from a real bondage or escape from it by a real act of evasion or self-extinction. It can only seem to some real self or being to exist. But in that case, this real self must in some way or in some degree have become subject to Maya. It must either be the consciousness of Brahman that projects itself into a world of Maya and issues from Maya, or it must be the being of Brahman that puts forth something of itself, its reality, into Maya and withdraws it again from Maya. Or what again is this Maya that imposes itself on Brahman? From where does it come if it is not already in Brahman, an action of the eternal consciousness or the eternal superconscience? It is only if a being or a consciousness of the reality undergoes the consequences of the illusion that the cycles of the illusion can put on any reality or have any importance except as a dance of phantasmagoric marionettes with which the Eternal amuses himself, a puppet show in time. We are driven back to the dual being of Brahman, the dual consciousness of Brahman involved in the illusion and free from the illusion, and a certain phenomenal truth of being for Maya. There can be no solution of our existence in the universe if that existence and the universe itself have no reality, even though the reality be only partial, restricted, derivative. But what can be the reality of an original, universal, and fundamentally baseless illusion? The only possible answer is that it is a supra-rational mystery, inexplicable and ineffable. Anirvakanya.
So here he continues to look at that relation of the individual being the percipient, the universe being the percept, and Brahman is something that is related to these. And so he raises that issue of how does it acquire reality, and it is sort of as if a kind of Sankhya duality that he begins with. So even in Sankhya, they say that there are two eternal independent principles. One is conscious, and it's the conscious principle, whether we call it a conscious being or just consciousness. And the other is a material principle, which is just a matrix of automatisms. But this material principle, in contact with consciousness, acquires conscious properties. And this is how you start having living matter or thinking matter as we experience ourselves as beings that are living and thinking material beings. But the being property is separate from, you know, the thinking, living, and material properties, which belong to matter in contact with consciousness. So he's saying over here that the reality of Brahman is in contact with this illusory, whatever it is that we are calling Maya, and within which there is whatever we call the individual. And the reality of Brahman lends itself to the individual and to its experience in the cosmic illusion, which endures so long as it is subject to the illusion. Okay. This again would be a similar kind of situation to the previous paragraph, where it is as if there is no reality to either the universe or the individual. And the extinction of the individual leaves nothing behind, nothing in its wake. The individual experience is not something that disappears back into Brahman, but it just is an illusion that disappears, that Brahman has withdrawn itself from, as he points out later. So it is either the consciousness of Brahman, as he says, or the being of Brahman that has entered. Okay, so he says, it must either be the consciousness of Brahman that projects itself into a world of Maya and issues from Maya, so that is what enters and leaves, or it must be the being of Brahman that puts forth something of itself, its reality, into Maya and withdraws it again from Maya. So again, it is without, I mean, cannot just by contact with Brahman acquire this kind of reality unless Brahman itself has supported it, either by entering it as a consciousness or as a being itself. As a consciousness, it would be, again, a kind of, you know, universe of automatisms and a individual existence, which is a kind of a, you know, formation of consciousness. As a being, it would be that the whole cosmos is a being, like a cosmic being, and that every individual is a being of Brahman. In other words, Brahman embodied, or Brahman acquiring these characteristics that we call prakriti. So in either case, the question is that Brahman has subjected itself to this condition. And if it has subjected itself to this condition, it must be conscious of this condition. Why is it kind of subject to this condition if it were unconscious of it, as it were, if it has entered it? So then he turns around and probes the issue of duality implicit in saying that Maya is some kind of illusion, and the individual is illusion, and Brahman is real, and enters into Maya. Then what is Maya? I mean, where does it issue from? What is its origin? Is it something separate? And here, of course, he is drawing on Vedanta. He's drawing on the Upanishads, And that is one what one might call the single assumption throughout this work, that there is one conscious reality that we call Brahman, that there is nothing other than that. So there isn't a duality, as it were. And if there was a duality even, how could you have a duality where there is something unreal and something real? Where does that unreal come from? So that is how he concludes that particular paragraph, and he ends it with the classic argument of Shankara, which is that we cannot know what Maya is. Yes, it cannot be apart from Brahman. It is a part of Brahman, but it is indescribable. As he says, inexplicable and ineffable. It's a supra-rational mystery. That Sanskrit word he uses is anirvachaniya. Vachan, of that V-A-C, you will recognize from the word vak, which means to speak. Vachan is to say or to describe. And anirvachaniya is indescribable.
I'm sure most of you know there's a little bookstore in Pondicherry called Bach.
Can't hear you, Matteo. Okay, let me see if I can raise. Can you repeat yourself?
I'm sure most of you know there's a little bookstore in Pondicherry called Vak.
Correct. Yeah, Vak means the word, and it's a Vedic term. It's actually a Vedic goddess, the goddess of the word.
I believe in etymology, it's related to the word vocation or calling.
Yeah, quite. Of course, vocation itself is related to vocal, and that vox, as in vox populi, which is a voice. And so here it is the idea of something which is expressed, and that's why he uses the term inexplicable, that ineffable, that is, cannot be understood, cannot be described or put into words.
Margaret, would you like to read next?
Okay. There are, however, two possible replies to the difficulty. If we get rid of the idea of absolute unreality and admit a qualification or compromise, a basis can be created for a subjective illusion consciousness, which is yet part of being. If we accept in the sense of an illusory subjective world awareness, the account of sleep and dream creation given to us in the Upanishads. For the affirmation there is that Brahman as self is fourfold. The self is Brahman. And all that is the Brahman. But all that is the self seen by the self in four states of its being. In the pure self status, neither consciousness nor unconsciousness, as we conceive it, can be affirmed by Brahman. It is a state of superconscience absorbed in its self-existence. In a self-silence, or self-ecstasy, or else it is the status of a free superconscient, containing or basing everything but involved in nothing. But there is also a luminous status of sleep self, a massed consciousness, which is the origin of cosmic existence. This state of deep sleep, in which yet there is the presence of an omnipotent intelligence, is the seed state or causal condition from which emerges the cosmos. This and the dream self, which is the continent of all subtle, subjective, or superphysical experience, and the self of waking, which is the support of all physical experience, can be taken as the whole field of Maya. As a man in deep sleep passes into dreams, in which he experiences self-constructed, unstable structures of name, form, relation, happenings, and in the waking state externalizes himself in the more apparently stable but yet transient structures of the physical consciousness. So the self develops out of a state of massed consciousness, its subjective and its objective cosmic experience. But the waking state is not a true waking from this original and causal sleep. It is only a full emergence into a gross external and objective sense of the positive reality of objects of consciousness, as opposed to the subtle subjective dream awareness of those objects. The true waking is a withdrawal from both objective and subjective consciousness and from the massed causal intelligence into the superconscious, superior to all consciousness. For all consciousness and all unconsciousness is Maya. Here we may say, Maya is real because it is the self's experience of the self. Something of the self enters into it, is affected by its happenings because it accepts them, believes in them. They are to its real experiences, creation out of its conscious being. But it is unreal because it is a sleep state, a dream state, an eventually transient waking state, not the true status of the superconscient reality. Here, there is no actual dichotomy of being itself, but there is a multiplicity of status of the one being. There is no original dual consciousness implying a will in the uncreated to create illusory things out of non-existence. But there is one being in states of superconscience and consciousness, each with its own nature of self-experience. But the lower states, although they have a reality, are yet qualified by a building and seeing of subjective self-constructions, which are not the real. The one self sees itself as many, but this multiple existence is subjective. It has a multiplicity of its states of consciousness, but this multiplicity also is subjective. There is a reality of subjective experience of a real being, but no objective universe.
So we find that Sri Aurobindo is finally rounding up to give us his view of the matter, which is ultimately also derived from the Upanishads and from a specific Upanishad here, the Mandukya Upanishad, and its description of the four states of being or the four states of Brahman, the waking state, the dream state, what he calls the sleep state, state with a capital S, or what some people call the dreamless state, and then finally the indescribable state, or the fourth state. And what he's pointing out over here is that the kind of descriptions he has given earlier of Maya and the individual being illusory have a certain kind of phenomenal reality, because it doesn't seem to be based in the absolute reality of Brahman. The absolute reality has to be beyond all dualities. So even the duality of consciousness and unconsciousness is something which it transcends. It is truly indescribable. And so we find that that origin of Maya is Brahman in its highest and absolute poise, absolute Brahman. But this state can impose upon itself certain other kinds of properties of consciousness. And the first of these properties of consciousness is a sort of subsidiary state of sleep. It's a kind of a massing of its consciousness, as he says. So he starts by talking about the absolute as either a absorbed self-consciousness. He says it is a state of superconscience absorbed in its self-existence, in a self-silence or a self-ecstasy, or else it is the status of a free superconscient containing or basing everything but involved in nothing. In other words, it is separated from anything that it may do or anything that it may enact in itself. It's either a matrix of infinite possibility that remains just like that, as a pure potential, or it is a matrix of infinite possibility that is turned, that has its consciousness turned in on itself. So there is either a positive direction, a concentration of consciousness upon itself, or there is a non-concentration of consciousness in a neutrality which yet does not manifest anything. So this is the absolute condition or state. And then you have within that, as it were, another state, a coexistence of the state of a luminous status of sleep self, a masked consciousness, which is the origin of cosmic existence. So here we find that this particular way of looking at itself is an operation of consciousness. So Maya has already kicked in. It is active. And it cannot be active from some source unknown to Brahman. It is Brahman itself. It's Brahman's own act of self-consciousness that creates a subsidiary massing of consciousness, as he says. And this massing of consciousness has got causality to it, because there is a super intelligent principle in it. This super intelligent principle is what he will call supermind. Hence, supermind is the property of Maya that is active in this subsidiary operation of consciousness. And so this is the causal, what is in the Upanishad called Sushupti. And within that, this intelligent principle is building its quote-unquote dreams. So these dreams, just as he started this entire paragraph by talking about dreams and comparing our dreams to the possibility of Maya as a kind of a dreamer, but illusory. And if you remember, the argument he posited there is that after all, our dreams are not that illusory. They have a logic to them. That logic may not be the same as the logic of the material world, but nevertheless, we have now arrived at a certain, at least a kind of a well, accepted view that dreams have meanings, that dreams have a certain kind of structure that unfolds in its own logic. And hence, there is an intelligent principle there as well. So he's saying that this so-called intelligent principle is the principle that is behind this entire cosmos as the dream of Brahman, you may say. And the dream of Brahman ultimately is a dream that has within it two dreams. One is the subjective dream and the other is the objective dream. This is a very interesting, succession of states of consciousness that is posited by the Mandukya Upanishad and that Sri Aurobindo is employing over here to show how everything fits together if we think of it in these terms. The subjective life of the human being, the consciousness of the human being, is something that partakes of the dream self of Brahman, you may say. That our dreams are not just our dreams, but that there is a kind of a dreams self of the entire cosmos, and our dreams are partaking of its quality. And this kind of idea is also held by certain philosophers of particularly modern philosophers that talk about the subjective and the objective realms as having independent reality. The first of these in our modern times is Henri Bergson. And Bergson is talking about this subjective reality. He uses the term duration. And he's saying essentially that that is the nature of time. It's the time body, you may say, of the universe. And by saying time body, what we mean is that space there is a property of time. While in the objective world, time is a property of space. So it's a spatially determined, a spatially oriented world into which we wake. And it's a temporally oriented world into which we fall in our dreams. We can understand this in this way, that in our waking world, we have objects. And it is as if all these objects have been, spread or arranged as the in space, in a kind of a container in space, in a primary, reality. That is the primary sense of the reality of our waking lives, that we move around as an object among other objects. And all these objects are undergoing transformations or changes. But if we go to the root of our dreams, we have the sense of a kind of a fused heterogeneity. It is as if all these objects that have emerged and arranged themselves with a certain level of permanence, never really permanent or transient, but enduring for a certain amount of time, it is as if they are all fused in dream, and they can emerge arbitrarily and return arbitrarily into that condition, which is a condition of some sort of transformations of that particular heterogeneous state. These transformations allow for the emergence into various types of configurations of the various heterogeneous properties of that consciousness. So that is the space or the spatiality of objects that is under the seen as a function of time, of the transformations of this inchoate or unformed, amorphous being, which is the subjective being of the cosmos. And then as it emerges, this becomes the objective world. So this relationship between the objective and subjective world is what Bergson posited, and he was calling for a development of a real kind of intuition, which was the intuition of time, temporal intuition, rather than the intuition of space, which is more natural to our existence. The same kind of idea is then taken up by Deleuze, who talks about the two realms as virtuality and actuality. So actuality is this waking state, and virtuality, he's not using it in terms of virtual reality as in cyberspace, but virtuality is more like this, the subjective space. And the subjective space is not just restricted to individuals or human individuals or even any living individuals, but subjective space is or subjective reality belongs to the entire cosmos, and we partake of it in our dreams, as it were. So this is how Sri Aurobindo is looking at a continuum of Brahman, where Brahman is at one level inviolate, absolute, beyond all categories, either as a neutral container of all possibilities or as a reality turned in on itself in a trance which is super conscient. And then within that, there are other statuses of Brahman which are dominated by ideas. And so the real idea or reality as idea of the super intelligent principle that operates as a dream of Brahman becomes the causal consciousness for the appearance of a subjective and an objective cosmos and the beings within it.
I'm going to venture that there is something important about this, I would call it integral vision that Mandukya Upanishad brings. And that is also the way of the consciousness, life and the unconscious life of the dreams against each other. And it's the relationship in that, that actually, I mean, if it's integral, it's moving between all of those states of consciousness at the same time and trying to find the actual, if you want to say, on a Marxist level, productive relations or relations of production that exist as opposed to a dissociated set of internal world, out external world, and an absolute world, that there's something, at least I venture out of that, to think of as being truly integral vision. Just offering that.
No, you're absolutely right, Justin. It is exactly a truly integral vision. And what ties it together is this, of course, there is a absolute, which in all philosophies, including that of, Deleuze, or if you want to talk about where he gets it from, it's Spinoza. There is an absolute which, of course, has entered and become this, but also remains outside of it. So there is an absolute which is not involved in productive relations, but there is also within it an entire succession of productive relations, as you call them, which is what makes it integral. And what connects the two are these real ideas. So, as it were, the principle of the dream. There is a principle of the dream which gives the logic to the dream. And that is what the masked consciousness or causal consciousness of the cosmos, which then differentiates itself into a subjective and an objective consciousness, which also are connected relationally or productively, because it's from the virtual that we come into the actual. And that's the whole idea of yoga, where we, you know, the Upanishads will say that as constituted beings, we have our organs of knowledge fastened with their doors outwards. In other words, we are given this objective condition with a privilege over the subjective condition, but we can kind of unfasten that construction so that we have access to the, you know, the causal state of virtuality from which actuality emerges and become much more creative, you know, agents of that of production. We can have the means of production, in other words. And then beyond that, we can come to an even greater, you know, sort of agency in the real idea that is the principle of the dream of the subjective and the objective in supermind. And that is exactly what Sri Aurobindo, that's where the whole integral vision sort of draws on this in saying that we have to emerge to a point where we, you know, kind of understand this productive relation at its root, as it at its causal root, and therefrom transform it. You know, that's exactly why you use the term the Marxist sense. So we can take the analogy of Marx. It's not really it's an analogy of Marx in the sense that there is the notion of transformation by arriving at the principle of the production. And so this arriving at the principle occurs in supermind, and he is talking about the sort of transformation of the dream and the and its objectification by arriving at that level and invoking its power to change these properties.
Thank you.
Deputy, speaking in evolutionary terms, when did this whole idea of the absolute arise?
The idea of the absolute is a philosophical idea that is very, very ancient. And, you know, it's sort of almost like an inevitability if we think about it, because if there is, unless we think of some kind of a limitation on being, as soon as we posit the possibility of a being that is truly illimitable, we have to say that whatever we experience, which we can call conscious being, is itself something which is already determined. It is a given, and this given state within which we are experiencing must have something even prior to it, which is truly not determined by anything, indeterminable. And hence, whatever properties we can give to consciousness, awareness, as deriving from our own experience, must be transcended in something that is both conscious and unconscious from that viewpoint, and from the viewpoint of our ability to experience. And that would be the absolute. The absolute would be defined as that which, you know, transcends every possibility of describing it. And description always presumes the positing of a property, and therefore also the positing of its opposite.
Thank you.
Justin, would you like to read next?
I think you just asked if I'd like to read, and unfortunately, I'm just not available to get the text, okay. But with much appreciation for what's being spoken. Thank you.
Okay. Karen, are you able to read?
Yes. It may be noted, however, that nowhere in the Upanishads is it actually laid down that the threefold status is a condition of illusion or the creation of an unreality. It is constantly affirmed that all this, that is, this universe we are now supposing to have been constructed by Maya, is the Brahman, the reality. The Brahman becomes all these beings. All beings must be seen in the self, the reality, and the reality must be seen in them. The reality must be seen as being actually all these beings. For not only the self is Brahman, but all is the self. All this that is the Brahman, the reality. That emphatic and assertive assertion leaves no room for an illusory Maya. But still the insistent denial that there is anything other than or separate from the experiencing self, certain phrases used in the description of two of the states of consciousness as sleep and dream may be taken as if they annulled the emphasis on the universal reality. These passages open the gates to the illusionist idea and have been made the foundation for an uncompromising system of that nature. If we take this fourfold status as a figure of the self, passing from its superconscient state, where there is no subject or object, into a luminous trance in which the superconscient becomes a mass consciousness, out of which the subjective status of being and the objective come into emergence, then we get, according to our view of things, either a possible process of illusionary creation or a process of creative self-knowledge and all knowledge.
So here he is coming to the crux of the matter regarding illusion. And first, he is pointing to the view that there is no idea of this fourfold state as producing illusions. Rather, it is clearly nothing but the self views of Brahman of on itself. It's its own ways of looking at itself, an absolute way of looking at itself. Would be completely beyond any description. But it can also look at itself through these various possibilities of self-ordering. And possibilities of self-ordering are real ideas. And such a possibility of self-ordering can be an ordering in space and time. You see, so these primary categorical sort of, you know, states of experience are become the, you know, ways by which the conditions under which Brahman may experience itself. And so this is a certain type of succession, just as Justin was saying. It's a certain kind of integral set of self-viewings related to each other, forming a process, as it were. And if that is the case, and if it is all Brahman's self kind of perceptions that are also related to each other, then are we talking about something which is completely the self-choice of Brahman, or are we talking about a set of illusions? And that's how he is, you know, bringing this argument to a close, as it were. Though he still posits at the end of this, if we take this fourfold status as a figure of the self, passing from its superconscious state, where there is no subject or object, into a luminous trance in which superconscious becomes a massed consciousness, out of which the subjective status of being and the objective come into emergence. Then we get, according to our view of things, either a possible process of illusionary creation or a process of creative self-knowledge and all knowledge. Depends on what you want to call it. If you call it an illusionary sort of creation, then we can say that, yeah, the absolute is the true and everything else is illusionary. But if we see that it is a deliberate choice of the absolute and nothing other than the absolute and its own self-perceptions, then it is rather a creative self-knowledge and all knowledge. A process of creative self-knowledge and all knowledge.
Debashish, going back to the, I had asked an earlier question, which you answered. I'm wondering that indescribable thing that human beings sensed. If the between our sleep, dreamless state, sleep, deep sleep, and dreaming and waking, which then we would have had to evolve to have an awareness of, but that we also had a sense of maybe the unity, the indescribable unity of all those three states of our consciousness or of our being, that gave rise to that sense of the absolute.
Yeah, that could be the case, Karen. So yeah, you are absolutely right in that all these states are coexistent, and in each of its, just as he says up there, in each of the of its self manifestations, all these states are actually present. And so, as he says over there, all is the self. All this that is the Brahman, the reality. That emphatic asseveration leaves no room for an illusory maya. Well, before that, he's saying that all beings, the Brahman becomes all these beings. All beings must be seen in the self, the reality, and the reality must be seen in them. The reality must be seen as being actually all these beings. In other words, in every being, the totality of Brahman and all these states are coexistent. They're already present. And we can intuit these things. This is the reason why even to imagine something is not possible unless we carry the faint intuition of its existence as an experience within our being.
Yeah, thank you.
This sense of a universal reality of which everything is a part seems to be arising again in out of the matrix of Western science. Some of the discussion of the Gaia hypothesis that I've been reading speaks about it in very materialistic terms, but seems to be trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, so to speak, by Describing, for example, describing the earth system as just a single being, and life as being an essential part of that single being, but it's not some, not just a bunch of separate objects, but it's one operation. And so it seems like from below, at least certain streams of thought are reaching again for this ideal of unity that Indian philosophy has this so central.
Yeah, quite true, John Robert. And the Gaia idea is sort of like the virtuality, the subjective reality of the material world. Just as we have our dream self, we may say that the whole earth has its dream self. And there, all the processes of the earth are inherent. And those transformations then express themselves spatially and materially in terms of what we see and the changes that we, experience as the earth. And so of what he is talking about, though, is that going, so we can go one step at a time and see larger wholes. And just as we seem to be contained in the earth itself is contained in an even larger subjective, cosmos that has material reality, but also vital and mental realms or strata that form the, you may say, the dream self of the cosmos with a capital C. And that dream self itself is then backgrounded by these great ideas that give them the logic through which they manifest, the kind of ideas that are at play in the world, including the master idea of an involution evolution, which is a certain way of looking at itself, Brahman's looking at itself, self-perception. And then we may even say that even beyond that, there is something indescribable. Now, the interesting thing, again, to come back to some extent to Karen's question about the indescribable and how it arises, is that things like the indescribable don't need the intuition of the others. We may reach for the indescribable almost before we arrive at the sense of the interconnectedness of the subjective and objective world or the ideational principle that belongs to it. So this root, the jump out of the cosmos to some absolute is one of the problems that he's dealing with, that it exists nevertheless, absolute which is non-determinate, indeterminate, indeterminable. And you remember this entire study of book two, part one, begins with that, the relation between the indeterminable and the determinations. There is a tendency not to look at the relations between these as a whole, but to jump out. And we can do that because the absolute goes beyond all determinations. But at the same time, we are missing out on something vital. We are missing out on the integrality of things. And we may say that we see that there's a certain kind of division that takes place between Eastern and Western ways of thought related to this privilege given to either the understanding of the relations between things, like a universal mind or a universal idea, and absolute that is beyond all ideas. So we find that all these Mayavadin schools, the so-called idealist schools or the illusionary schools, jump out of any particular ideational basis, in fact. I mean, they jump out of it into a like he says, anirvachaniya reality, a wordless, indescribable reality. Or in the West, you find overmuch, and you talked, John Robert, about science and the scientific, view, which is sort of driven by the intuition of the order of things and tries to find the idea behind all this order. And so we find that these two views of reality are not given enough, the relationship between the two is not expressed. And that's why we have different views, a kind of an illusionistic view and a logocentric view, if you call it that.
I was just wondering if this sense of the absolute, maybe in human beings anyway, comes from the experience of awe and mystery, the awareness of the self, the human self, the small self in relation to the immensity of experience.
Yeah, very true, very true, John Robert. And I think that is one of the roots of that sense of the absolute. And we find that there, again, as we were talking about different views on reality from the East and the West, we find that particular view on the absolute also has different attitudes. For example, the philosopher Kant, Immanuel Kant, talks about two approaches to the universe, and one is that of beauty and the other is that of the sublime. And beauty is so perceived by us because we intuit the perfection of order, you know, that it is miraculously ordered. It's so well, beautifully ordered that it's almost like the infinity of the property of order that surpasses our ability to actually put it into reasonable terms. But yet we intuit a reason in it. And then the sublime is our sense of the infinite that is beyond order, that can be, so overwhelming that it can engulf and obliterate every possibility of order. And so to awe, to the sublime, the awe of the sublime, he posits a property of fear as well. There is a fear element in our apprehension of the infinity of the absolute. But at the same time, along with it arises the trust or the faith in reason, according to Kant, which says that the ordering principle has emerged out of this and can actually build itself a home within this infinity, within this all-obliterating infinity, and experiences a sense of relief from that knowledge. This is how Kant looks upon it. But if we compare it with the way in which the absolute is apprehended in, say, the Indian tradition, the absolute is a comforting presence. It is infinite. And beyond all, ability to understand. But the idea is that the divine is the soul of the absolute. The divine is the one, the Purusha or the Purushottama, The Ishvara is the one who is the friend of man, who is the very soul of every individual, as he says, has become every individual. And hence, surrendering to the absolute is something that can include the integral.
Oh, that's a very interesting way of posing the relationship between the Western view with the fear and the attempt to discern order in the Eastern view, which maybe has some more of surrender and friendship in it.
I mean, it may be a little bit of an oversimplification, but, you know, because you always have exceptions in every, you know, cultural view. But generally speaking, this has been the kind of one of the sort of historical, when we think of the historical evolution of ideas, that is what differentiates. These are not essentialisms. It is not that the East was made different and the West was made different. It is just the way in which certain concerns have been historically addressed, and an entire evolution has derived from that, that we come to world views in certain regions.
Debashish, this isn't, there isn't time, of course, but John Robert making that comment, there's such implications culturally, politically, on how these two worldviews are now, even now, interacting.
Yeah, quite true. I mean, that's why this is such a special time, because we are face to face with all the various cultural histories of the world that are mingling, that are confronting one another. And it really takes, you know, kind of like a sorting through and understanding these things to arrive at an integral vision. That is one idea of it, one of the sort of notions of integrality again. Because we find that it's the parable of the blind man and the elephant, where each of the blind persons feels one part of the elephant's body and takes that to be the whole. And it's only when they describe it to each other that they find that their descriptions are completely different. And then they have an option of you know, harmonizing their descriptions and coming up with a total description, or they may fight with each other ad infinitum, believing what they believe to be the whole reality.
I know this may sound simplistic, but I don't know if one way you can say the difference between the East and West regarding the whole absolute is that in some ways the East could relate their subjective experience in some way. What you said, a friendly way to the absolute. In the West, there seems we were more concerned with the absolute's emergence or whatever, seemed more concerned with the objective world, and there was a unity that seemed to emerge in terms of all of the natural events or in nature, and it's at least reading the Old Testament, and that there was less of a friendliness. how shall I say? Like about the other gods and goddesses, and the sort of an intolerance of anything that kind of blocked the view of this absolute that was behind everything in the objective world. I know that's stated kind of awkwardly, but I think the absolute was emerging in both in East and West, but differently, and the sense of it.
I'd agree with that. And you find also this kind of idea of the absolute in its relations with the ordering principle, as well as the subjective and objective worlds, to be present within Western intellectual thought, and particularly the thinkers that we are calling Enlightenment thinkers. You have some very prominent thinkers there, like that, for example, Spinoza, who in various ways is much closer to this view that Sri Aurobindo is talking about, because primarily he comes from a uncompromisingly monistic point of view, that everything is the one. There is one. Whether we call it matter, even if you're talking about matter, he's saying that ultimately, what is matter? We have to probe it. We have to approach it with the question, what are its properties and what are its capacities? Even the body, he says that from that point of view. And if we can go far enough, we'll find that it is sort of in a continuum with everything else, and arrives at spirit, that entire continuum, that these states of being that he's talking about are everywhere, in everything. And so there is a kind of a tradition of that sort as well. But it seems to be dominated more by the will to order things and to find the ordering principle that is almost the absolute. I mean, the absolute gets equated with that almost. And then when that is exceeded, then there is the sense of awe, which includes fear. Of course, in a pre-modern time, there was a greater sense of quote-unquote God, which, like the God of Abraham, as they say, the God who is to be feared. And that's what you were talking about, Karen, I think, in the two approaches. It's in Judaism, it's in Islam, the all-fearful God. And you do have a little of that, but it's always the mother or, the God who is our very soul and best friend, you may say, that emerges in the Indian view on the absolute.
Yes, and I know there's been more recent developments in the West, that take in more the subjective as well as the objective realm. But I was thinking of the start, and there's been this intolerance for, less of a wide embrace. And I think what you said about the ordering makes sense. So something that's outside of what's perceived as outside of that order is something to be very much afraid of. Yeah. So if the ordering is made, the perceived order is made the absolute, then you run into problems.
Yeah.
I just see so much more intolerance built into earlier the monotheistic, the Western monotheistic religions than in the East, for example, of other beliefs, other gods, goddesses. You know, there's been this. And I was reading something really interesting that, in some ways, all the paintings of the Madonna and the Child, that just was something constantly done by the artist early on in Christianity, were somewhat a reflection of trying to give us that feeling of that friendly relation again. That mother, like you were saying.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's interesting. So there you find that's in kind of Catholicism. And, you know, so yes, in Catholicism, that idea of the mother as, you know, something that mediates between the mystery and the human soul was part of the remnant of an older, you know, more integral structure, perhaps. You know, it was already something that couldn't encompass the totality. It had to be conditioned by certain properties, you know, the properties of compassion or the properties of you know, while you find that the so-called fearful in the Indian tradition, like Kali, for example, is also the mother. And you find ecstatics like Ramakrishna, who completely accepted her as his own mother, more close than any other being, and in relationship with him. And so it's a very interesting, you know, so kind of complexity.
Thank you.
Joanna, would you like to read next?
Okay. We're starting, it may be noted.
No, it's the next paragraph. It starts with in fact.
In fact.
Yep.
Yes?
Yep.
In fact, if we can judge from the description of the three lower states of self as the all-wise intelligence, and footnote, prajna, Yajnavalkya in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad states very positively that there are two planes or states of being, which are two worlds, and that in the dream state one can see both worlds, for the dream state is intermediate between them. It is their joining plane. This makes it clear that he is speaking of a subliminal condition of the consciousness which can carry it in communications between the physical and the superphysical worlds. The description of the dreamless sleep state applies both to deep sleep and to the condition of trance, in which one enters into a massed consciousness containing in it all the powers of being, but all compressed within itself, and concentrated solely on itself, and, when active, then active in a consciousness where all is the self. This is clearly a state admitting us into the higher planes of the spirit, normally now superconscient to our waking being. So I'll start again. In fact, if we can judge from the description of the three lower states of self as the all-wise intelligence, prajna, the seer of the subtle and the seer of the gross material existence, this sleep state and this dream state seem to be figurative names for the superconscient and the subliminal, which are behind and beyond our waking status. They are so named and figured because it is through dream and sleep, or trance, which can be regarded as a kind of dream or sleep, that the surface mental consciousness normally passes out of the perception of objective things into the inner subliminal and the superior supramental or overmental status. In that inner condition, it sees the superphysical realities in transcribing figures of dream or vision, or in the superior status, it loses itself in a massed consciousness of which it can receive no thought or image. It is through this subliminal and this superconscious condition that we can pass into the supreme superconscious of the highest state of self-being. If we make the transition, not through dream trance or sleep trance, but through a spiritual awakening into these higher states, we become aware in all of them of the one omnipresent reality. There need be no perception of an illusionary Maya. There is only an experience of the passage from mind to what is beyond, from mind to what is beyond it, so that our mental structure of the universe ceases to be valid and another reality of it is substituted for the ignorant mental knowledge. In this transition, it is possible to be awake to all the states of being together in a harmonized and unified experience and to see the reality everywhere. But if we plunge by a trance of exclusive concentration into a mystic sleep state, or pass abruptly in waking mind into a state belonging to the superconscious, then the mind can be seized in the passage by a sense of the unreality of the cosmic force and its creations. It passes by a subjective abolition of them into the supreme superconscious. This sense of unreality and this sublimating passage are the spiritual, sublimating passage are the spiritual justification for the idea of a world created by Maya. But this consequence is not conclusive, since a larger and more complete conclusion superseding it is possible to spiritual experience.
So here we find that he's pointing to the root of this idea of the illusion as one which jumps, as we were discussing earlier, from the waking state into a sleep or trance of superconscious without including or passing through these intermediate states. And also over here, he is clarifying one of the quotations that he started with at the beginning of this chapter, which is the quotation, this is the chapter 6. If you go back to chapter 5, I believe, if you go to the beginning of chapter 5, let's see. Well, there is a quotation from Brihadaranyaka Upanishad there, but even that is not the one that he's referring to here. Let's see. He had given this very quotation that he is referring to over here, earlier in this, in our reading. I'm trying to see if we can find it. No, somewhere it seems to be lost. In any case,
There are some quotations in the beginning of 6, but I don't know if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. No, there was another one where he talked about this dream state that he's talking of over here. Okay, yeah, it is chapter 5. It's in the beginning of chapter 5. It's exactly that footnote is referenced. You know, I mean, it's that passage that he's referencing in the footnote. If you look at the beginning of chapter 5, you'll see the second quote. It says, "This self is a self of knowledge, an inner light in the heart. He is the conscious being common to all the states of being and moves in both worlds. He becomes a dream self and passes beyond this world and its forms of death. There are two planes of this conscious being, this and the other worlds. A third state is their place of joining, the state of dream. And when he stands in this place of their joining, he sees both planes of his existence, this world and the other world. When he sleeps, he takes the substance of this world in which all is, and himself undoes, and himself builds by his own illumination, his own light. When this conscious being sleeps, he becomes luminous with his self-light. There are no roads, nor chariots, nor joys, nor pleasures, nor tanks, nor ponds, nor rivers, but he creates them by his own light, for he is the maker. By sleep he casts off his body, and unsleeping sees those that sleep. He preserves by his life breath this lower nest, and goes forth immortal from his nest. Immortal he goes where he wills, the golden Purusha, the solitary swan. They say the country of waking only is his, for the things which he sees when awake, these only he sees when asleep. But there he is his own self-light." So here you find that he's referring to this part, which there are two planes of this conscious being, this and the other worlds. A third state is their place of joining, the state of dream, and when he stands in this place of their joining, he sees both planes of his existence, this world and the other world. So here, you know, as he points out, there are three states that are being talked about. One is a state of waking, one is a state of dream, and one is a state of sleep, as he calls it over here. And the two worlds are the worlds of waking and the worlds of sleep, and the worlds of sleep, which are what he calls the superconscient worlds. And in between is the world of dream, which is what he's calling the subliminal world and the subliminal consciousness. And the subliminal consciousness is the state of dream, or it is what one might say is what we enter into in dream, and the entire gamut of the inner planes of consciousness leading up to the overmind. And the state of sleep is the passage from the overmind into the supermind. And so what he's saying is that this intermediate state, this subliminal consciousness, this consciousness of dream, is what connects the luminous planes of the superconscious and the state of waking. And the two meet there. And he's talking really about the overmind. And so basically what they're trying to point out is the need to, you know, sort of reverse the focus of our consciousness from exclusively waking material objective reality to a inclusion of the subjective world of dream And then from that into, because that is the link, from that into the superconscient worlds. And the first of the superconscient worlds is this world of sleep, which is, you know, what is called Sushupti in the Mandukya Upanishad. And in this world of sleep, we have that beautiful description in that very same passage, you know, where the being has woken up from both the waking and the dream, and is the solitary swan and the golden Purusha that is really the cosmic creator. Everything is the self-creation of the supramental being at that point. So this is the way in which he, Prajna. Prajna is the masked intelligence or the real idea through which this both subjective or subliminal and objective or material worlds are extended, are related and extended. But he's pointing out over here that we can enter into these worlds by sleep and by trance. We can pass by sleep or trance into the subliminal world, and by an even deeper sort of trance into the world of sleep or the supramental world, the supra, and beyond it, the supraphysical worlds. But if we do that, then we have jumped out of the, there is a discontinuity between the states of consciousness. And due to this discontinuity, we start believing that whatever we experienced in the waking state was an illusion. But instead of that, if we wake spiritually into these worlds, this is a very important distinction that Sri Aurobindo is making. That's a practical distinction as far as his teaching is concerned, which is that it is not just experiences of these things that we are called to have, but it is the building of a continuous consciousness, the ability to pass from one to the other in a continuity. And the mother talks extensively about this. And she talks about how, because of these discontinuities, we don't remember dreams, and we also move from plane to plane without a real understanding of the structure and the productive relations, as Justin was talking about. But that if we can kind of develop the continuities of consciousness, if we can form these, the ladder of being within us, then we'll find that there is a seamless, you know, continuum of consciousness from the absolute to the waking, taking these other two states in between. And if we do that, then the sense of illusion completely disappears. We see that this is the reality. So that's the part where he says, in this transition, it is possible to be awake to all the states of being together in a harmonized and unified experience and to see the reality everywhere. But if we plunge by a trance of exclusive concentration into a mystic sleep state or pass abruptly in waking mind into a state belonging to the superconscient, then the mind can be seized in the passage by a sense of the unreality of the cosmic force and its creations. It passes by a subjective abolition of them into the supreme superconscience. This sense of unreality and this sublimating passage are the spiritual justification for the idea of a world created by Maya. But this consequence is not conclusive, since a larger and more complete conclusion superseding it is possible to the spiritual experience. So that is the, you know, the he puts this argument in a state in its concluding form by talking about both this structure as well as the experience of the structure, the psychology or the psychological philosophy of this particular you know, relation between the states of reality.
Devashish, is he also making the case, I think, for that spiritual experience is how one sees the truth of what he's saying?
Yeah, it is spiritual experience, but he's also making a distinction between types of spiritual experience. You see, this is the interesting part, because just by spiritual experience, we still experience discontinuities.
Yeah.
What he's talking about in part Sri Aurobindo's teaching consists in actually not only experiencing things of the spirit, but in constructing a ladder of continuity. This idea of building continuity between our present waking condition and the states of consciousness that are presently hidden from us is the central teaching, one may say, of the integral yoga.
And he's encouraging us to do this.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he ends by talking about these two kinds of multiplicities, again, which we were discussing, the virtual and the actual, or that which belongs to the subliminal and to the material, you see. But the lower states, although they have a reality, are yet qualified by a building and seeing of subjective self-concentrations, which are not the real. So this is actually a kind of, so we are seeing these derivations, which are, unless we go to the root, the causation or causal root, they become secondary, and therefore they are not real in the same sense as the origin. The one self sees itself as many, but this multiple existence is subjective. It has a multiplicity of its states of consciousness. But this multiplicity also is subjective. The seeing itself as many is also subjective, but that to us is objective. We see the objective world as composed of many different things distributed in space, but that is really a subjective self-seeing of the one. And then in dream, we see this, you know, more amorphous heterogeneity, which is a multiplicity of the states of consciousness, but that too is a subjective self-perception of the one being. And so that is the both the subjective and the objective worlds are the subjective realities of Brahman.
If there are no other questions, perhaps we can stop for now and continue next time.
Thanks.
Okay. So, Devasudha, we'll stop now and we'll continue in 2 weeks.
Okay, let me see. So, 2 weeks from now is, let's see what date that is.
It's going to be the 22nd, and I suppose you will be in India then.
Yeah, I'll be in India on the 22nd. So, I'll let you know beforehand. Most probably, it'll be very possible to do it. Mm-hmm. But I'll confirm before, you know, that on that week, I'll confirm the possibility.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Devasudha. Thank you, everyone. I'll put up the recording for this soon. Meanwhile, we'll decide whether we want to do the class on October 22nd or continue next time.
Okay.
Thank you, Devasudha.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Bye.